Blog Talk Radio.
Turnbuckle Turmoil fan, Sign Guy, and QT with you here on another Sunday afternoon. Some show notes before we jump into thing with our guest today. If you're looking for some wrestling, if you're in our neck of the woods, you have DOA Pro Wrestling in Portland, Oregon, as well as Blue Collar Wrestling like every Sunday at the North Portland Eagles. You can find me at BCW later this afternoon. You can also find my merchandise, so bring extra cash to buy a shirt. Without further ado, though, I want to jump into things real fast with our guest, someone I have known for a long time. If you've been to wrestling shows in the Northwest, most likely you have come across our guest today, Stuart Kemp. Welcome to the show.
Hey, welcome, Sign Guy and QT. Glad to have you and glad to be part of the show today.
Well, normally we start with a traditional first-timer's question, but just a slightly different twist today. When you were at the CAC this spring, I know that you got ill down there in Las Vegas, so I want to start off by asking how the recovery has been since you took ill at CAC.
Well, what it was actually what I thought was food poisoning. I had some food earlier in the day on April 30th. I thought it was food poisoning because it didn't taste the sausages right. It just didn't taste right. But I continued with the cribbage tournament upstairs in the nostalgia room, and everything was good, or I thought it was good, at least halfway decent enough. Went across to the Arizona Ballroom where they were doing the wrestling show that night, and was finding I was doing the announcing that night. So I headed down the escalator, and all of a sudden I all the lights started spinning around, and grabbed onto the banister for dear life, and swung into a chair. I don't know how I did it, about 6-7 feet away. Was carted away in an ambulance to the hospital in Las Vegas. In my discharge papers, this is a suspected cerebral hemorrhage. A couple of days later, I had another episode when I was at work, and this time they took me to the hospital for 5.5 weeks. Ended up being two different strokes. One was called a Borrella stroke, which is in the brainstem, and one is a cerebellum stroke, which is in the brain or in the back part of the brain. And both of those things there basically hospitalized me for 5.5 weeks. So up until June, I couldn't walk. I couldn't even swallow very well. Talking was still an issue, and a lot of other issues as well. Some of them have recovered for sure. Some of them still, I'm told that this particular stroke can take anywhere between 1 and 2 years to recover from. So, I'm glad I'm on this side of the earth instead of the other side. And, I've been talked to Scott Thiel actually just recently from, who's now the executive vice president of the CAC. He also writes a great wrestling memoirs and writes a number of books on the Southeast, and B. Brian Blair as well, about doing the cribbage this year. And one way or the other, I'm going to make it to CAC. I don't know how I will, but I just got clearance from the doctor this last few weeks to fly. So I can drive again as well. So that's a good thing. So, look for me at CAC. You'll see me in the nostalgia room, probably about 40 or 50 pounds lighter than I was when I was at CAC last year, but I'm ready to go.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, and I'm glad that I can see you are recovering. Every time I have seen you since then, you seem to get a little bit stronger, so I'm really glad to hear that.
Well, so am I.
Now,
I mean, the upper body sucks, but the lower body's okay.
Well, I'm just glad you're still getting around and you're still
us.
It could have been a lot worse.
Well, there's a lot of people, in the last 6 months or so, I've seen actually a lot more on the TV and in the news about people who've had strokes, some who have recovered, some who haven't. And I've talked to people who've had strokes and some have recovered and some have taken a turn for the worse. And so I, you know, I just keep trying every day. I thank everybody for all the messages that have been sent when I've been doing my Facebook Live, and I've been doing a lot of other different things to educate people about the stroke, because there are a variety of different strokes. There's many different kinds. Some affect people differently. I found out a wrestler who had wrestled in Tacoma just this last year could never speak again because of a stroke. I know a friend of mine who had 5 strokes on the right side of their brain is finally able now, 5 or 10 years later, to sort of recover. Still has some issues here and there. It can happen. We had an NHL referee who just died recently of a stroke. So, I mean, you know, the stroke can happen at a variety of different ways, a variety of different reasons. And all I say to everybody out there is go to your doctor, get checked. If you don't have a chance to get the results that you want, and I'm not saying that you want them, if you find that you're not getting the results you need, make sure that you get a second opinion. Make sure that you're getting checked because, a stroke can be debilitating for sure. There's a lot of things in your body that you don't have anymore. And so I encourage everybody, just make sure you get checked as often as you can. I know we don't have commissions that much anymore in the States. We don't have very many in Canada for wrestling. But we see a lot of wrestlers having strokes and so on that look healthy. So make sure that you're getting checked, please.
Absolutely. Well, our normal question, which I'll ask you at this point in time.
Sure.
How did you get started in the professional wrestling industry?
Well, like anybody is a professional wrestling fan. You know, you've got to be a fan first in order to get into this business. I mean, you know, you're told to do things a different way than you normally do, and so that's part of your training. But, you know, you've really got to be a fan to do this. And I was a fan growing up in the 70s watching guys like Eric Fulick, a barefoot wrestler in Vancouver, Canada. Not a big guy, but great talent to watch. Along the lines of Edouard Carpentier, another old-time wrestler back in the 50s and 60s, a great high flyer. But it was an angle that I saw in December of 83 from Stampede Wrestling that turned me into going to a live event, and that was a match between Archie Gouldie and Bad News Allen. You remember them as Mongolian Stomper if you watched the Southeast, and you remember Bad News Brown from the WWF. So, they were, at that time in Calgary, and it was a night that Bad News turned on Archie. It was a night that Stu Hart ended up losing $250,000 from the commission at that time because what they thought was legit, was what they wanted to see on TV. And News and Gouldie brought their match to Vancouver. They pretty much sold out the Agrodome in Vancouver, British Columbia, and it got me hooked as a fan. You know, one of the things that I saw was Danny Davis, who had wrestled as a Nightmare Danny Davis in Memphis, one of the runners of Ohio Valley Wrestling, was a great talent in Calgary, but he was a small guy. He was like 5'5", 190 pounds maybe. You know, this is 190 pounds. And I was thinking to myself, and at that time I think it was 140, 150. I said, if I could be 190 pounds, I could kick his ass. That's what I thought. You know, of course, now things change a lot, but that's how I got into the business, is that I watched it and I was a fan, and I was brought into the business by Smith Hart and Bruce Hart, given the chance to announce actually at a show, and then as a performer and a manager through Michelle Starr. So that was a big thing, and that was in the early 90s. So, for some of you people who saw me in British Columbia, in Idaho, in Washington State, Oregon, that's where I began. I started as a fan. You know, everybody needs to be a fan first, but, you need to have a focus. And nowadays, I think it might have changed things a little bit. I probably would have finished school. Nowadays, please finish school.
And like you said, you not only were in Canada, but across the Northwest United States. A lot of people know that in different regions of the country, fans are different as far as what they like, what they don't, how they react to different things. What were some of the differences you noticed between fans in Canada and fans here in the United States?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the best matches I remember was a match I had with Ladies' Choice in Nanaimo, British Columbia. Lady's Choice was a bad guy, villain, heel, whatever you want to call it, and so was I. And they matched us up together in a match in Nanaimo, and Lady's Choice was going over on that show, and Elsie was going, you know, they hate me. He says, there's no way that they're going to buy into me. I said, let me go out first. I said, let me get the crowd going, and I mean, they were a pro heel town. They loved the heels. They didn't love the pretty baby faces, and so you know, Lady's Choice having to be one wasn't going to work, or so he thought. Of course, I went out there and I found three teenage girls that were, I looked at them. And I said, yeah, these ones are going to love Lady's Choice. They're going to love the long hair. They're going to love the teeth. They're going to love the tan, everything. And of course, you know, being a heavy set guy and so on and so forth, they're going to hate me. So I made sure I worked on them. Well, sure enough, it worked, and they turned on me big time. And they got the rest of the crowd basically to fall in line, and they hated me. And when Lady's Choice came out there, he got a huge thunderous applause. Of course, he killed me with a frog splash at the end, and then I had a little bit of set to with the referee. And basically, I walked out of there as the bad guy, you know, the whole night. Elsie gets the back. He's like, what the hell just happened? I said, that's what happens when you're a heel. And that's, you know, the problem nowadays is that we don't have definitive good guys and definitive bad guys, definitive baby faces, definitive heels anymore. We did have that when I was in the States, you know, in Washington, Oregon. We were still at a time of what is known as kayfabe. It's basically disappeared. I mean, now everybody reads all the sheets. They read the internet, so on and so forth. They think they know what's going on, but they've never been in the dressing room. You know, they think they know what's going on, but, you know, there's a reason why you sit in the seat in the front row or in the back row, whatever else. You know, you want to be a fan. You know, I've gone to shows, whether it's BCW or DOA or NWA or whatever else, and I've always sat in the back row because I want to be taken away on a journey. You know, I want to be a fan. People who think that they want to read all these insider gossip and everything else, they don't want to be a fan. They just want to be watching all these different things that are on the Facebook various things that they have nowadays to get the insider scoop, so to speak, but they don't understand the inner workings of the wrestling business, and there is really an inner working of this, of the business as such, and that was one of the things I noticed, was that, you know, Washington, Oregon, and Idaho fans were fans first. There were a few fans in British Columbia, especially in the outskirt areas, people that hadn't had wrestling in a long time, but people who had been exposed to the WWF at that time, definitely were very much into the sheets and the internet and everything else, and thought they could trip you up by saying some insider terms and so on and so forth. And I just look at them and go, you know, what were you doing, guys? Just sit there and be a fan. That's all I do.
Now, in addition to wrestling, you've done pretty much everything that there is to do in the business of professional wrestling, from in-ring wrestling, commissioner, ring announcer, refereeing, you've done it all pretty much.
Yes.
What do you think that having done everything did for you as far as making you more valuable to the companies where you work? Because I try to tell everyone coming up that the more they can do, the more valuable they are. I don't know if a lot of the younger guys grasp that, but you seem to grasp that and utilize it. What do you think it did for your career?
Well, I mean, the thing is that because I was so versatile, because I was a guy who could basically do anything in any time, it allowed me to basically work for so many different companies. I mean, I was a booker, a matchmaker, if you so speak, in some territories, and I was a referee in other territories. I started as a manager, who then ended up being a wrestler, because managers always end up having to wrestle, especially the good guys, and so I did that. I took the tickets. I sold the merchandise. I created the matches. I went to towns and did all the front work, so I did all the postering and all the advertising and all those sorts of things. I put together shows so that when a venue was coming up, I'd take a look and see if it was something that we could do for wrestling. Some didn't, you know, because of the ceilings. Some didn't because of the price. So I did, you know, basically everything. I wrote matches. You know, so basically I look at a TV. You know, I was putting together videos and TV and that sort of thing. I sort of timed out all those. I created characters. I had several different wrestlers in the Northwest that I am particularly fond of, that I thought that, did a tremendous job, and I gave them a shot. I gave them a chance to be on our shows, and they flourished. I mean, we had one guy who wrestled a couple of shows in Washington and Oregon, flourished and became a major talent in championship wrestling from Hollywood for a period of time. I've created characters like Tony Terrific and G-Shock, who became the American Idols. And then I don't sit there and tap my horn. I sit in the back, as I said, and try and be a fan. So many people ask me what I did in the business and so on and so forth. And, I tell them only because of the fact that they ask. But, I've never sat there and gone, well, I created this guy. I did this and I did that. One of the benefits of being involved in the business is what I have is being able to do the cribbage tournament at Cauliflower Alley Club. And that's a reunion for retired wrestlers, boxers, people in the media, people in films, some of their wrestlers, some of their boxers, and so on. I'm sure I've rubbed shoulders with a few of them. But I'll tell you, one of the biggest kicks I got was a few years ago when I attended my first CAC. And I had this guy come up to me. He says, oh, you're Bulldog Bob Brown Jr. I saw you wrestle back in 2001 in Everett. Granted, this was 13 years later. Now, remember, all these matches that you've gone to and all these different faces you've seen and everything else, and you can remember me. What did I do special? Well, it was just because, I made sure that everybody had a good time, they were entertained by what they saw, and that at the end, people remembered who I was because I made sure they remembered who I was. It was, whether it was a wrestler that, I made sure that the referee hated me a lot, or the wrestler hated me a lot, and so fans, wanted to pelt me with garbage, and they wanted to boo me and everything else. Those are things that we just don't have anymore. Everybody wants to be slick and polished. You see all these characters now on TV, they're slick. They've got all these different outfits that they buy through High Spots and ring wears and such. I mean, I bought my boots originally from B-Bar A Boot Shop, which doesn't exist anymore, in Paris, Arkansas. I bought my second pair of boots at Reno's in Vancouver. And I don't know if he makes the boots anymore or if anybody does the boots anymore. But now you can buy them for $100 at High Spots. But they're cheap knockoffs. I mean, these boots that I have lasted me for 20-some-odd years. And they still, still keep going. You look at these guys that buy these other boots that last them about a week or so, and they buy another pair, and it's like, well, you want to call yourself a wrestler? This is what we had to do. We had to, buy our equipment from various trained techniques. I mean, we had to go to Adrian Street Bazaar in Florida to get our trunks. They were expensive, or your tights. Now you can go pretty much anywhere and buy your gear. And I mean, anybody thinks that they call themselves a wrestler, and that's another thing is that. Even though I can't do the things I want to do in the ring anymore, I've still got a great mind, and I still think that I can provide some to some businesses. I just haven't been given the call. My phone doesn't ring anymore.
One of the things that most wrestlers have, for one reason or another, is a favorite venue where they've performed. Wrestling can go pretty much anywhere where there is space to fit the ring and some chairs. So there's all manners of different venues, some really good, some a little strange, some not so good buildings. What would you say has been your favorite venue for wrestling that you've come across so far?
The best, unfortunately, it no longer exists because it's now the Raymond Burr Theater, but it was the Eagles Hall in New Westminster, British Columbia. That was a building that had sort of like a two-platform sitting area. One was behind a wooden fence, which we call basically the regular area, and then just below the wooden fence, you drop down about two stairs, and you'd be in what was called the danger zone. Basically, wrestlers would land on you. There was blood, there was tears, there was everything else, but we could cram 400 fans into this building, and it was wall-to-wall people. I mean, there was barely enough room for you to breathe, let alone anything else. I remember being both a wrestler there and an announcer there, and then also a TV guy. And the room was electric. I mean, there was no two ways about it. If you have a chance to see any of the Eagles Hall stuff, it reminds you a lot of what the ECW arena was in Philadelphia on a much smaller scale. These were 400 fans that were, you know, internet savvy. They had read the sheets, they had read all the books and that sort of thing, but they wanted to be entertained. And believe you me, these guys that went in that ring every night and did all their toils and so on and so forth, my God, they looked unbelievable. And the Eagles Hall was a scary place to be because you really had no room to escape. If ever there was a problem, and fortunately there never was, but if there was a problem, you had nowhere to go. I mean, you were basically pinned in the ring, and you couldn't get to your the dressing room. The safety of the dressing room was probably about 50 feet away, and it was down a flight of stairs and then into a locker room. And that was a scary, scary place to be. But I'll tell you, if you ever have a chance to see, and this ran from 96 when we debuted Extreme Canadian Championship Wrestling until it closed in, well, 2001. It moved to the Bridgeview Hall because the Rainbow Theater had taken over that venue. But the Eagles Hall in New Westminster was definitely the best place to catch wrestling. I mean, it's like Calgary. If you go to Calgary, you want to go to the Victoria Pavilion. If you go to Portland, you want to go to the Portland Sports Arena. You want to go to Roy Shire, you see the Cow Palace. These were the meccas of wrestling. There was something about these home bases that just made you want to go. And, I mean, the crowds, they showed up big time in all these venues, and it's unfortunate they no longer exist because, you know, the fans today just miss an awful lot of what was really a tremendous time in professional wrestling.
Now, since you have been around for quite a while and you date back to the mid-80s when you were breaking into the business, a lot of fans know that in that era, unfortunately, there was a lot of rampant drug use in the wrestling industry as well as all major sports. A lot of them that were legal now have been made illegal, so they're no longer legal to use by the performers, but at the time there were a lot more lax laws. You could do some of the things that you can't do now. It was a different era, but we've lost a lot of wrestlers early because of their past drug use, or even sometimes from current drug use taking its toll on the body. I know you were around in that era when it was very rampant. Did you ever see guys that were out of control from drug issues or even drinking issues that you wish someone had stepped in and sat them aside to have a discussion?
Well, I don't know. I don't want to name the performer that I know specifically, because I know that that he's still alive. But I know that one of the family gave him some stuff, told him this could take it after the show and everything will be fine. Well, he took it before the show, and he ended up having to wrestle a battle royal that night. This was in Edmonton, Alberta, and it was probably about 86, 87, maybe 88 probably. And I remember him going out first, but he wasn't supposed to go out first. He's supposed to go out later in the match. And he gets to the back, and the guys are looking at him, what the hell are you doing back here? He says, I couldn't work anymore. He says, hell, I saw four of everybody. And so, you know, back then, I mean, you know, there was a lot of abuse. I mean, we just recently lost Tom Billington, a.k.a. the Dynamite Kid. He had a video released not too long ago that was narrated by Davey Richards. On, you know, and he's asked about point blank about steroid abuse, and he says, do what they want. And I'm going, well, I mean, granted, back in the day, that was true. You could do what you want, take what you wanted. There were things, I'm sure, that Tommy took in his system that weren't steroids. You know, they were other things, you know, and they were sold as steroids, but they really weren't. Because back at that time, even though, quote-unquote, they were legal, there was still a stigma about them. So, you know, we didn't talk about them. But, I mean, you only have to look at Dynamite Kid to get an example of where a guy starts at maybe $1.50 when he started in Calgary in 1978. And by 1982, he was 220 pounds, but he was ripped for the muscle. Well, how do you get that way in 5 years? You know, I mean, you could work out to your death warmed over, but you don't look like that. You know, there's no two ways about it. And unfortunately, there are people that take various substances and so on, thinking that they can get there. Now, remember, though, back in that time frame, these guys were working anywhere between 250 and 350 days a year. It was not uncommon for them to work three matches in one night in three different towns. One, they would work the first match in the East Coast, then they work the middle match in the middle frame, and the Midwest, and then they work the main event on the West Coast. And then they fly off to Europe or Africa or South America or whatever else. You know, there were guys that couldn't sleep, so they took stuff to get to sleep. They couldn't sleep on a plane, so they had to stay awake, so they had to say something, stay awake. They had to, a variety of different things. I mean, there were pharmacies all over the place, you know, quote-unquote pharmacies, doctors who would prescribe pretty much anything. There were guys who had several hundred prescriptions that they could take into a pharmacist at any time and get whatever they needed. Granted, a lot of that happened one time. I'll give you an example. About 10 years ago or so, we had a friend of ours that was staying here, and he asked one time, he said, what are you looking at? And I said, well, I'm looking at all the rest of that died before age 40. And he said, let me take a look at that paper. So I printed it off, and he took a look at it, and started crossing off names. He started, shedding a bit of a tear. And I said, why are you crying? He says, all these guys died before I did. I wrestled two-thirds of them. And, you know, this is, you know, a sobering fact. I mean, nowadays, guys are working maybe once a week, once a month, once every couple of weeks, whatever. I mean, the most that I ever wrestled on one show in a row was 14 cities in 17 days, all over British Columbia. So I traveled, 3,000 miles to go to all these various towns. Some towns were great, some towns sucked. I mean, it just the way it was. But can you imagine if you were working pretty much 5 or 6 days a week, 20 days or 25 days a month, and you were doing that for an entire year, and then you tried to do that, for the next 10 years, people seem to think they were making lots of money. Well, the fact is that I don't think the money has really gone up since that time. And, I think the guys were, the top guys were making $500-$600 a week, and I think they may get a couple thousand if they're lucky in Japan, but they have to fly 20 hours to get there, and they only may work once or twice. So, and then they have to travel 8 to 10 hours to get to a venue and so on and so forth. So it's not an easy gig. It's not like some of these other things you can do that basically get you wherever you want to go, and you make a lot of money fast. I mean, you don't make very much money on this wrestling business, and you take toils in your body. There are days that I get out of bed now, I creak in certain spots in my body because I don't have cartilage anymore. I ruptured my quadricep. I had a partial tear of my quadricep while at work a year or two ago, and it was because of just grinding and toil from the years of landing on my knees. And I basically had no cartilage in my knees anymore. It's just part of the business. And, people seem to think, oh, yeah, you can do all this and you can, not have any suffering at all. And, the fact is you do. Now, you see a lot of these guys, they're lucky. They get to the gym all the time and so on and so forth. Back in that time, you were lucky if you went to the gym once a week. I mean, you were very lucky. And if you did go to the gym, you were lucky if you spent an hour there because, you had to get to the town. You had to get to another town. He had a facade you had to put up. You had to, stay at an expensive hotel because you had a facade. You had to look like you were making money even though you weren't. Mick Foley talks about in his book all the time, he stayed at Motel 6. There were lots of other guys that were staying at these other hotels that were three times the money, but they had to stay there because they had this quote-unquote impression to give. So that's a big mistake. Nowadays, I mean, we've got some smart guys who do this full time. They are very frugal with their money. I mean, they sleep in their car still. They sleep on somebody's floor. Maybe they sleep at a safe house, somebody's house that allows them to rest without having the fans come and bother them. And they eat very meagerly. I mean, they go to a dollar store and they buy some Spam or something like that, or they try and buy a loaf of bread. They try and make some tuna fish sandwiches, to last them a couple of weeks. And some of the guys who are listening to this program know exactly what I'm talking about. I mean, that's what we went through. We didn't go to restaurants. I'll never forget one promoter that used to talk about going to McDonald's and taking all the ketchup packages. Well, why would you do that? He said, well, you take hot water and you take the ketchup packages, you have tomato soup. And that's what he would have for the next few days. And that was just because he needed to save some money. And that's just how it was back in the day.
Now, we talked earlier about the differences in crowds and that type of thing. What would you say was the hardest crowd for you to win over to get across what you wanted to get across during the show? I mean, just a crowd that for whatever reason wasn't reacting the way that they normally would. Maybe they just weren't easy to please, that type of thing. What was the hardest actual crowd you had?
Oh, it was a small crowd. It was probably about 50 people or so on Vancouver Island. A lot of these people sat on their hands, and they were basically like, well, entertain us. And it's like, you know, well, we are. We're like the court jester in the kingdom. You know, we wear the funny hat. We wear the funny pants. We dance around the ring half naked, so on and so forth. And the crowd just didn't care. And, you know, we've had a few of those here and there. And all you can do is just do your thing. You know, you're told to by the matchmaker to, you know, fill up 10 minutes. So that's what you do, and you find ways of creating it. Sometimes you're lucky and you catch a spark. You know, maybe the crowd, there's a bit of a snicker, or you get a bit of a boo or whatever else, and you work with that. I mean, you know, the best you can do is just hope to God that you get out of there alive and that you're not smarting too badly from the butt hurt that you got from the crowd that didn't care about you. You know, it happens. But all you can do is, you know, do what you do. Now, people seem to think that if you change up everything, that all of a sudden the crowd will win, you know, you'll win the crowd over. And that doesn't always happen. I mean, there are crowds that, for whatever reason, just crap on you. They hate everything you do. They hate what you look like. They hate who you are. Maybe they had a bad day at work, whatever else. You know, you try and find something, anything. You look for something in the town that can maybe get those people going. Maybe it's a local team that, you know, is doing well, so you crap on them. Maybe a team is doing badly, and you build them up as though they're God's gift to green earth. I mean, there's lots of different things you can do. The biggest thing is that a lot of our guys are reading notes now. They read books, and they read texts, and they think that, you know, if I act this way, then the crowd will win over. And, you know, that's not the way we did it. You know, back in the day, we just, you know, we went out there. If the crowd hated us, we found ways to get them to like us. If they didn't like us, we found ways, you know, or liked us. We wanted to find ways that they didn't like us. Nowadays, I mean, people want packaged. You know, wrestlers want packaged. They come up with a bag full of suits and all these fancy schmancy boots and, you know, kick pads and fancy, you know, pleather pants and shirts and whatever else and try to pretend that they're something they're not. One of the great things was that the best wrestler was an offshoot of yourself. If I could be somebody that was an arrogant bastard all the time, which I was, and portray that in the audience, then they would hate me, and they did. And they did with a passion, and so I was very fortunate that way. But so many people, they want to be all these packaged things. They want to watch all this internet stuff. Well, you know, if I behave like this, the crowd will like me. Or if I behave like this, the crowd will hate me. It's like, guys, do what you do best. If they don't like you and you want them to like you, then find ways to get them to like you when you're in the ring. If you find ways that they like you but you want them to don't like you, then do that in the ring. Don't sit there in the dressing room going, well, you know, I think maybe I'll do this and maybe I'll do that. Just go out in the ring. If you see what's going on, then that's what you do. I mean, and you flow, you go with the flow. I mean, you see all this time right now with the wrestling on you know, the major promotions and so on and so forth. You know, people crap all over these certain individuals, and they still do them anyway. Well, why not change your shtick up? Why not just have the crowd hate you if they want to hate you, and see if that flies, and then maybe take it to the promoter or the matchmaker and say, hey, listen, this doesn't work. But they're afraid because the matchmaker or the guy in the gorilla position or whatever else is sitting there going, well, you know what, this guy is getting over with this crowd, blah, 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 we're going to, you know, ixnay him or whatever else. And it's unfortunate because I think that there's a lot of talent that is being reduced because they can't think for themselves anymore. They are dumbed down, if they want it, so to speak. You know, they, you know, they read all these things and they think that that's how they need to be. It isn't, and that's sad.
Agreed.
Well, at this point in time, my co-host QT Vokes is standing by, and I'm sure he has questions, so I'm going to pass things over to the capable hands of QT.
Alrighty.
Well, thank you, Sun Guy. Hello, Stuart.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm thankful for your recovery. That's good. Yes. Well, Stuart, when you were working for Extreme Canadian Championship Wrestling, did you ever train or maybe run into or hear of a wrestler named Casey Spinelli, a female wrestler?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I wrestled on shows with Casey Spinelli a lot. You know, she was one of the workers there along with, I'm trying to remember all the different, Bam Bam Bambi was one of the main ones that I was teamed up with. Casey Spinelli started about the same time or maybe just a little bit after Bambi got started. But there were others that had been there. Bree Todd was another one that had wrestled as well. She wrestled as Madison, I think. And she was another great worker in ECCW. There were a lot of other great great women wrestlers. And fortunately, we had some great trainers in both Michelle Starr and Juggernaut that trained at the House of Pain in Langley, British Columbia. They trained some tremendous wrestlers. It was actually the debut then of Asian Cougar and Hiroki Arariwa, who I don't know if he works anymore, but I know Cougar still does and still comes out with Dontaberry Pro Wrestling, comes out every so often to Vancouver, B.C. to do shows. So it's really nice to see him, but it's really great to see where these talents have gone.
Now, does Casey Spinelli kind of remind you of Northwest wrestler G-Shock?
Oh, she's a talent of her own, though. G-Shock was a great wrestler on his own right. You know, he was one of those guys who, like me, tried to get his fingers in everything. You know, and now he's this very successful MMA announcer, and he does TV and so on. You know, I can tell you that Casey Spinelli was a great wrestler in the Pacific Northwest. And she got her hands into a lot of different promotions. But because she was a great talent, she was able to farm herself out to pretty much anywhere she wanted to go. But she spent several years in the Northwest. Great wrestlers always spend a good portion of time in one territory to hone their skills. And then when they get out, I mean, they flourish beyond belief. And she was one of them for sure.
Wow, all right. Stuart, are you familiar, or does this name sound familiar, a former Northwest wrestler, David Hollenbach, who is now
yes.
a jiu-jitsu instructor as well as
yes.
MMA?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Dave Hollenbach actually started as Havoc. He was trained back in 97, 98, I think. And he was with Chance Beckett. They were known as the High Five and White Boys in ECCW. And they were basically the pasty white fan favorite team. They were the babyface team. And they wore the belts a few times on the Pacific Northwest and were just a tremendous talent. I know that there was a contentious marriage with him and another lady who had been in Canada. He brought her to the States. She had wrestled a number of times in Canada as well. And she had done very well, and so did Dave. And Dave, unfortunately, he had suffered a very serious injury. One of the shows that we did, I think it was around 2000 or so, in Auburn, Washington, we wrestled against Michelle Starr, and he did what is known as an acai moonsault, which is basically a moonsault out from the outside of the ring, grabbing your opponent, grabs you, and basically you fall to the floor. He accidentally kneed the guy in the face, and so he couldn't be caught properly. And he ended up breaking his femur on the floor, but we didn't know what it was, and he wanted to finish the match. Kudos to him for doing this. I don't know if I would have been so brave, but I think it's one of those things, the adrenaline goes through your body, and then when you get back, then all of a sudden you can't do that. And I can relate to one of those situations as well. But they called for a waiting ambulance, and he's out of action for about a year or so. He still dabbled a little bit in pro wrestling, but he found a niche for MMA. It was like, you know, it was one of those things that, you know, you could be an individual with MMA and with jujitsu and so on and so forth, and that's what he's flourished at, and now his two kids are involved with it heavily. He's got other kids that are now involved in the jujitsu. They're much younger, but the older kids were brought up through the jujitsu, and he's been a main force in Tacoma for years in training prospective people in jujitsu, and has been learning the martial arts and learning the ability to be able to focus your attention. I wish I could half the time, but he has, and more power to him for sure.
Well, I saw Dave Holland back last night, and for reasons that, we work at the same company, Pierce County Security, and he stops by in his mobile unit at the Brown and Haley Candy Factory. He did last night, and we started talking about wrestling. Yes.
Yeah, he likes it.
Now what?
You know, that's one thing that we do is we still like talking about wrestling. We may hate it, but we still love it.
Yes, he has a sophomore daughter who's a sophomore in high school that's about in the 115-pound weight class. Watch out for her this year. Yes.
Yeah, I saw a picture of her. My gosh, she can still kick some serious behind. I know even at my best date, I probably wouldn't have been able to take her for sure.
Well, she looks tough, and he also has a son who's an Army Ranger, and he's spent about 10 years in the Army. He's already in E7.
Yes. Well, again, it's one of those things that Dave always made sure that he trained his kids to focus their attention. If they really wanted something, they would grab that brass ring and go for it. Here's a guy, I'll drop another name here, Tony Kazina. He wrestled originally back in 96 as Tony Kasinga. He was called Tony Kasinga by Dutch Savage because Dutch didn't like them using their real names. So instead of Tony Kazina, he was known as Tony Kasinga. And he wrestled up in Canada as Tony Kasinga. He was maybe buck 10, buck 20. He was a very small kid. And he wasn't as built as he is today. Well, he worked around the horn. He built himself up. And now he trains wrestlers in New Zealand. He trains wrestlers in all over the States. And he was one of the proteges of Matt Bourne, who originally trained him to wrestle. And he trained a number of other wrestlers, guys like Chad Manning, Chuck Gordy, Mark Watson. He trained all these. Mark Watson was a referee, but the other three were wrestlers. And so Matt instilled a very big focus issue on a lot of these guys. Unfortunately, I don't see a lot of them paying it forward in going back to their roots, where they were originally trained from. I talked to Ron Hutchison a lot of times, and that's another name that I'll drop again. He comes to the CAC every year. Now, Ron Hutchison, you go, who is he? Well, he wrestled as Wonder Boy in the Maritimes and in Toronto, and so who is he again? Well, he's the guy who trained Edge Christian and Trish Stratus, among others. He still is a very, very approachable individual. But these guys paid it forward. They trained their prospective talents. Ron still talks a lot about the business, and he loves talking about his business. Even though he's far gone from this business, he still loves talking about this business. He still likes training wrestlers, and he trains them with a focus, attention, so that we are not just all this thing on TV like a cookie-cutter wrestler. We're all looking like we're big muscles, and we're all wearing the same kind of shorts, and we're wearing the same kind of pants, and we're saying that whatever. They were all different. Edge, Christian, Trist, they were all different. It was like Matt Bourne trained four different people. They were four different performers. So that's what I want to see. So I want to see a lot of guys, if they're training guys, I don't want you training your image. Please train as if they're individuals. Train them so that they can become, great at what they are. And Dave was one of them. I mean, Dave was a great talent because, he went out on his own and forged on his own, and Chance Beckett did his own, and both of them succeeded where they needed to. So that's great.
Wow, very good, very good. I'll tell Dave hello for you when I see him next at work.
Yeah, I talk to him every so often on Facebook, but I'm sure that you checked out the sweets while you were at B&H, huh?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm sure you did.
Yeah.
It's Christmas time. You can do that.
Oh, okay. Now,
now,
speaking of Christmas time, Kentucky Fried Chicken recently started selling KFC fire logs in time for the holidays.
$20 to buy a log that smells like a chicken. I don't want it. I don't want it. No way, not for $20.
Well, if you were a young wrestler today, would you use one of these as a foreign object? Your opponent smell like chicken?
No, but I will tell you, one of the best, I'll tell you another story. So we were in northern British Columbia in a town called Quesnel. We had a wrestler who was a vegan, full and full out vegan. So he didn't eat meat at all. We had one of our sponsors who was Canadian 2-for-1 pizza. We had a meat lover's pizza delivered. And so it was a come as you are, wear what you want, bring what you want, battle royal. Well, you can guess what happened. So the guy brings this pizza in, was vegan, and smushes it in his face. You know, there were some fun times for sure. I mean, we were serious, but we were also silly at the same time. We understood what we needed to do, and there were things. I wrestled a hardcore match against a midget one time. Everything we had was buffoonery. I mean, there were water noodles, and there was I can't remember half the things that were there. But we made it look like it was legitimate. So people need to see that, and they did. I mean, they loved it, and that was the great thing, is that, you know, we brought a legitimacy, even though we did buffoonery, we brought a legitimacy to this industry, which some say, you know, I wish we could go back to.
Well, I was intrigued. Now, here's a guy that was never cast as a buffoon, Andre the Giant.
Yes.
Did you know, have you heard stories about him playing cribbage?
No, I have not, but I can't even see him holding the cards. If you see him with a picture of one Molson Canadian beer, it basically encompasses his half of his hand. I never saw him at the CAC during the time as I was there, and I talked to a few of the guys that ran the tournament before I did, and they didn't have him there. But a couple years ago, we had a few people that played. Greg Gagne was one that played. Bob Orton Jr., Cowboy Bob Orton, played this last year. We've had Rebel Bill White, who's played a few times. So we've had a smattering Destroyer. The Destroyer Cribbage Tournament is named for him because he plays every year. Everybody thinks he cheats. You know, I don't know if he does or not, but he plays very slowly. And he counts his points, makes sure he gets all of his points for sure. But he's a great talent to have as well. And you can imagine, he's 87 years old and still flying to the CAC every year. Why encourage people to go to the CAC? And why people should go to the reunions, whether they go to the Gulf Coast reunion, or they go to the the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame, or the other halls that are around the Gulf Coast is another one, Wrestlers Reunion. You know, there are times, and we were talking to a sign guy just a few minutes ago, was how many guys have passed away before the age of 40? Well, this year especially, we've lost a lot of great talent. Larry Henning and Dynamite Kid come to mind just right off the bat, and just not including any others that have lost this last year. But we've lost many others as well. One of the great things about these reunions is you have a chance to be able to see some of your brethren. And whether you like the business or you hate the business, and I hear, you know, there's some that really despise this industry. I mean, I'll give you a name like Al Madrill, for example, hates this industry. I don't know why. It made him a boatload of money, but he hates this business, and I wish he would come to the events sometime. But these guys that go to these tournaments and these reunions and so on, it's incredible to see a lot of these talents, where they've gone to, what they've become. I just wish that we'd see more of them. I know that, like, the CAC has 8,000 members, but we have probably about 700 that show up every year in Vegas. We probably have about 1,000 or 1,500 at Gulf Coast. We probably have about 50 or 100 or so that show up there. You know, the same thing with the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame. There's probably about 100 or so that show up there, but there's probably, you know, a few thousand that belong to the Hall of Fame. I wish people would go, because this is the only time that you are going to see some of these talents again, and maybe ever. You know, it's just very sad to say that some of them are going to be gone, you know, at the end of this year. I mean, I could have been one of them. I mean, I could have been a stat as well. Fortunately, I'm not. I'm still standing. But there are others, you know, that have had this particular thing that no longer are with us. So, you know, I encourage everybody, you know, go to your reunions, please, you know, even if you only go to one, see some of these people, make some contacts, see your people that you know very well, talk to them, get some insight, you know, and one of the other things is for the up-and-coming wrestlers, also go to your Hall of Fames and your reunions and so on and so forth, because a lot of them have wrestling shows, so you can be part of those, but more importantly, you get to rub shoulders with guys who have gone through the business before you did, so they can tell you about the pratfalls, they can tell you about the traps that are there, they can tell you who to work for, who not to work for. One of the great things, if you are in a room, let's say CDC is an example, there's 500 or 600 people that are at the wrestling event. There's probably about a couple hundred or so wrestlers that are there, and they come from all over the states, Canada, Mexico, Japan, overseas, etc. What's great about these talents is you can talk to them and find out, hey, maybe you can, you know, who's the promoter in this town, blah, 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 who's the promoter in that town, yada, yada, yada. You know, get some information, send your packages. You can get some names. Sure, you can look on the net, but it's great to be able to talk to some of these guys and be able to showcase your talents to some of these guys, because when they go back to these towns, they can say, you know, this guy, blah, 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 was working at the show in Vegas. He looked really good. You know, I'd like to have him booked on the show here. I'd like to work it myself. You never know. And there are some great stories that come out of this because of this. You know, I don't know who runs the show in Texas, but I know that Billy Blade out of Vendetta Pro Wrestling runs the event in Vegas. You know, it's a great night of wrestling. There's probably about half a dozen guys that are sitting there putting together matches. There's probably about 10 or 15 matches on the show. It's a very long show. But, you know, even if you don't work the show, rub shoulders. Get some communication going. Talk to the people. Get some word of mouth out about you and talk to people. I mean, that's what you do.
Well, Stuart, I brought up the subject of Andre the Giant playing cribbage because I've heard, I think it may have even been from Stone Cold, that Andre, maybe it was mind over matter, but somehow Andre the Giant could use his fingers to move those cribbage pegs. He was quite adept at that.
Well, I tell you, Destroyer moves him too. He moves him a little bit too much, in my opinion. But, sadly, though, that's again the thing, is that you need to go to a lot of these reunions because there's a lot of guys that you may never see again. You may only see once, and then again, you may never see again, or you may strike up a friendship and you see them every year, which is a great thing. You know, I see some of these guys at the CAC every year. We bump into each other a couple of days before the reunion, and we talk shop, and it's great because, you know, we don't have any fans sitting around. And even if you were a fan, you could still talk to some of these guys, and they're very approachable. They're not like a wrestling show where they have a booking to make or they have a show to make or whatever else. These guys are here for the couple of days or whatever else. This is the chance to bend their ear and learn some insights. Now, don't act like a fool, though. I mean, get your information and get out, you know. Don't try and be their best friend, because they're not going to be. If they want to be your friend, they'll let you know. You know, very simply, they'll let you know. And if they don't want to be your friend, just leave them alone.
Wow, very good advice. Okay, all right. Well, Stuart, we had B. Brian Blair on our show, and it was one of my particular favorites because I told B. Brian that in the course of life, there are some people that just have the golden spoon, and they get special privileges. For instance, Dave Beckham, the soccer star, he once walked into the DMV, and it was very crowded, and he just walked right into the front of the line, past a lot of people, to the head of the line at the DMV. I think it may have been in Phoenix. And, you know, the people recognized him, and they didn't really complain. They just thought it was pretty normal for a big star. And Paul McCartney once drove up to Heathrow Airport in his limousine, parked right in front of the loading zone, walked right in and did his business at Heathrow Airport, came back down, and even though his limousine was in a no-towing zone and there were police there, the police asked for his autograph. And of course, as Limo didn't get told. Now,
yes.
I told B. Brian Blair that I was going to make it a crusade, a turnbuckle turmoil crusade, to get B. Brian Blair front of the line privileges. Will you join
nice.
Us in this quest?
Nice. Well done. Well, B. Brian Blair, he was appointed as the president of the CAC a couple years ago. Unfortunately, just about a couple months later, Nick Bockwinkel, who was the past president, passed away at the age of 80. And Brian has done a tremendous job in trying to get that CAC going again. I know they've had some inner workings with the board and so on and so forth. Some hasn't been great, some has. But what's good is that there's some stability again. I'm sure Brian will be there for many years to come. And, you know, he's a very approachable individual. And I was talking about approachable individuals. Here's one as well. So if you go to CAC and you see Brian, you can strike up a conversation. You can talk to him for a couple of minutes. And he won't bat an eye. You know, you were talking about the privileges. There's a reason why a lot of those guys like Beckham and McCartney and so on can go in and get there and get out quickly. Well, number one, these places do not want that kind of limelight, spotlight around them. They want to get them in and out quickly as possible. They don't want them waiting in line. Number one, they don't want autograph seekers. Number two, they don't want to be that guy who prevented this guy from getting his paperwork, you know, filed and get out of there quickly sort of thing. So I can understand that. Brian, you know, has had a great career. Obviously, he's one half of the Killer Bees, but also with a comic collection now. He has a comic collection, and he's now the president of the CAC. He had a wrestler's luncheon just recently in Florida, which unfortunately I couldn't make because of this debilitating illness. But, you know, he's done a tremendous power, as have all of the board members and past board members of the CAC and the PWHF and so on and so forth have done, all these reunions have done tremendous work in trying to get these people to come to these events, so on and so forth. You know, it's a struggle every year, obviously, because they're not names on TV anymore. They're not people that you recognize. I mean, Brian, you could probably remember a little bit, but he's not on TV anymore. So for him to be able to get certain guys to come to the events is a big thing. He uses his name for sure to pull some of the guys that he's got coming to the events. And I'm sure the same thing happens with Johnny Mantell when he does the PWHF. He uses his name to draw people into the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame. And I'm sure the same thing happens when it comes to the Gulf Coast Wrestling Reunion and so on and so forth. But I tell you, everybody needs to go to these reunions. You know, it's just a big thing to do. You need to go, and you need to be part of it. Actually, I'd love to see Brian get further privileges, but I don't know if he would accept them or not. I think he would be sheepish and shy away from that because he wouldn't want the limelight spotted on himself either.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I think he was very intrigued that I first saw him in an autographed photo on a coffee house in Key West in 1986 when I was stationed there. He seemed fascinated by that.
Yeah, now imagine, he was trained by Hiro Matsuda, the guy who broke Hulk Hogan's leg and a couple of other things.
Yes.
I mean, he trained a lot of great wrestlers. Unfortunately, we lost Hiro this last couple of years to death, unfortunately. But he was one of those guys that trained great wrestlers. And Brian was a great talent in Florida. But here's another guy who morphed himself out to a lot of different promotions and got picked up by the WWE or the WWF at the time and was a mainstay for several years there. So, you know, good for him.
Okay.
Well,
it was great
last
talking.
2 minutes of show. Stuart, I want to give you ample time. If there's anything you want to say to the listeners today, plug and promote absolutely anything, social medias, the CAC, merchandise, anything you want. Floor is all yours.
Well, unfortunately, I don't have any merchandise at all because I was one of those guys that never sold merchandise. You know, I sold a couple of bootleg tapes, but that's about it. But I tell everybody, you know, if you haven't had a chance to go to a reunion, feel free. Check out pwhf.org or call alleyclub.org or Gulf Coast Wrestling Reunion. I don't know what that web address is, but look it up and become a member of them. I want you to go to the reunions if you can. Become a member of all these different places. If you're a wrestler, if you're a talent, inform yourself out to all these different promotions. You know, nowadays social media is a big thing. Back in the day, I mean, we made posters. We still, you know, foot traveled everywhere. We car traveled everywhere. Nowadays, everybody can basically send an email, and you can be halfway around the world in seconds. I mean, that's the thing. But go to all these different places you can. Get your name out there. Become somebody. I mean, we take a look at a guy like, here's an example. Funny Bone is an example. Here's a guy who was trained by Nick Bockwinkel back in Vegas back many years ago. He's farmed himself out all over the world because of the fact that he has created a niche for himself. He's created a website, created merchandise, created everything. That's what you want to be. If you aspire to that, then that's what you need to do. You just need to farm yourself out. But get to all these places. Talk to all these people. Become a member of all these different promotions and all these different groups that are reunions, and get to all these reunions you can, because you will learn so much from all these different people. It's not funny. Get to all your local promotions. You know, support your local promotions as well, because they are the lifeblood of what makes professional wrestling succeed. I mean, we didn't have that back in the day. Nowadays, you do. I mean, social media is a big thing. Now you can walk into a show and they're pretty much sold out once a week, once a month, once every couple of weeks, whatever it is. And it's because of the fact that they have a lot of interest from the audience. You don't have that anymore, or you didn't have that back then. You do have it now. So make sure that you go to all these promotions. Get your name out there. Talk to the promoter. Talk to the agent who is handling the shows there, and get your name out there. Take a videotape, take pictures, whatever else you can, and talk to them and see if you can be part of their shows. You never know.
Well, Stuart, it was an absolute pleasure having you on the show today. I appreciate you taking the time to join us. Very glad that recovery is going well for you, and I'm sure I'll come across you at some point in the near future.
Now, if anybody wants to email me, of course, they can check out BulldogBobBrownJr.1@yahoo.com. They can check out me, Stuart Kemp, on Facebook as well. You know, I try to go live once a month or so. I think the next one is a Monday in January, second Monday in January. People will learn about the stroke again, so they'll learn a little bit more. And then I'll hopefully be at CAC at the end of April. So please come and play cribbage. Please come and learn there. And please come to a show. Hopefully we'll see you at the shows. And if you see me, come up and say hi. I don't bite, at least not intentionally.
I can confirm that he's never bitten me yet.
Not yet. Oh, sign guy, there's the moment. I'm just thinking if it's an arm or a side rib there.
As long as it's not like the middle of my forehead and we do an Abdullah the Butcher thing.
No. I haven't met him, although I hear he is. He was supposed to be at CAC last year. Hopefully he will be at either PWHF or CAC this year. He's another guy that could tell some tremendous stories. Remember, this guy's been wrestling since 1958.
Absolutely. Abdul's got some stories.
Oh, yeah.
Well, fans, if you see Stuart, go up, say hello to him. He's at a lot of shows here in the Northwest. Has an amazing mind for this business. Has a lot of information he can help share. Stuart, I look forward to the next time you're on this show for sure. Fans, if you're in Portland, there's a couple shows going on. If you're up in Alaska, NSA Wrestling is about to start. NSA, definitely a great promotion. Get out there and support them in Palmer, Alaska today. So wherever there's wrestling near you, get out there, support it, and we will talk to you next week.
Of course you are.